Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast celebrating the 15th anniversary of films you don't care about. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kamenguser.
Yes, so last episode we took a look at a very highly regarded horror noir from 1987 from director Alan Parker, starring Mickey Rourke and Charlotte Rampling, with music by Trevor Jones. And we decided we were going to follow that.
We, David?
Okay. Maybe
who picked the film this week, David?
All right, I'm gonna level with everyone. I didn't give Andrew an option in this one. I just simply chose it and went through with it. And that is the Stephen Norrington film from 2003, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, starring one Sean Connery and produced by Don Murphy, the man of a million and one terrible movies.
Looking at that one of them. So League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. It's imagine if the Avengers was written in the Victorian era and nobody cared.
Yeah, so I guess to back this thing up, because I think we're tipping our hat as towards our feelings of this movie a little early on.
Yeah, maybe. I'll probably come down and love it by the end. So I guess first, though, how on earth do we get from Angel Heart to LXG?
So we're following composer Trevor Jones, who wrote the very effective and creepy score for Angel Heart, to this not awful score for this movie. It's just kind of generic. You're not going to remember it afterwards, but, you know, it's fine work. That's about all we can say about the music. But, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. If you don't know this movie, and you're about the same age of us, which puts you in about your early 30s, your late 20s, it's kind of hard to blame you. This thing more or less came and went at the box office in 2003. And since then, I mean, it's been brought up in lawsuits and has been threatened to have been turned into a TV show.
threatened. Yeah, most people would say optioned, but in this case, it was a threat.
Yeah, I'm sure Alan Moore considered threatening somebody when that was announced, but which I guess brings us to, you know, what the heck is the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, you know, and its origins prior to this 2003.
Well, yeah, because... and I guess here, correct me if I'm wrong, David, but your previous podcast, 24 Panels Per Second, did you ever have an episode looking at League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
We did not, which is why I felt this one was fair game.
Okay, so the rationale creeps forward. But yes, if you haven't been able to tell by us playing inside baseball and talking about Alan Moore, unlike the other films that we've looked at so far, LXD comes as an adaptation of Alan Moore's graphic novel.
Yes, and it's a comic that was first published in 1999. It's been a series of different, more or less, mini-series. He co-created it with illustrator Kevin O'Neill. It began its publication in 1999. And quickly, I mean, within 4 years, there was a film based off this thing, which, when you consider all things, that's a pretty quick turnaround.
That's quicker turnaround when you consider, like, the early aughts is sort of that dead zone of superhero cinema. And anyone who's listened to your previous podcast or read friend of the show Drew Jeffrey's dissertation, the superhero genre has a very tumultuous history. And it seems that there is that strange little gap where we see films like Blade come out. We see films like From Hell, another Alan Moore opposite of masterpiece. And, I mean, the genre really kind of kicks itself into high gear as a legitimate art with Batman Begins. And that happens, that's 2005, is it?
That's 2005, and then 3 years later we get the sort of doubleheader of The Dark Knight, which, whether you love or hate that film, certainly brought a level of respectability and critical acclaim to the genre that hadn't been seen preceding things, and also gave us the beginnings of the Marvel MCU officially, with Iron Man and The Incredible Hulk were both released that year. So, I mean, yeah, really, it's about this film is about 5 years preceding what I think we can sort of view as the firm kick into high gear of the superhero genre, particularly superheroes based off comics.
And that's why it's so baffling that there is a 4-year turnaround between publication and the film being released for a property that people like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. Like, it was fairly well received, but it's not like it was flying off the shelves and people were clamoring. So when nobody's making comic book movies, this is the property that gets picked up, and this is the one that's picked up with, you know, enough motivation to get it out as soon as it is. And that's weird to me.
It gets even weirder when you consider that the studio that produced and released this film is 20th Century Fox.
Mm.
And not only 20th Century Fox, but 20th Century Fox under the leadership of Tom Rothman. And for those who don't know what that means, he was the studio head at the time who, I think it's fairly straightforward to say that he didn't have particular love of the genre, as it were. This is a man who apparently, when the X-Men film, which was released under his watch, went into production before he took over, did not like the project, wanted to kill it, and really dragged his feet after it turned out to be a big success, and certainly at the same time was very resistant to things such as making a Fantastic Four film that happens to have a giant purple dude in a helmet named Galactus on screen, because apparently that wasn't his deal. What he did, however, seem to like were things like Master and Commander, films that he really pushed his
I forgot that for. I saw that in theaters.
Yeah, and it gives you a good indication of just how kind of weird it is that LXG, number one, is made by this studio regime. In 2003, the same year they also released Daredevil, for that Mark Steven Johnson's classic film into theaters in a chopped up messy form. And yeah, like, I mean, they don't seem to like these movies. And yet, and again, you have source material, which, and we'll get to in a minute, but which could go in a million and one directions. And yet this is the direction they chose to take it. Because the thing about the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen comics is, I would not classify these things as superhero comic books to be transformed into a superhero film. Would you agree with that assessment, Andrew?
I would agree. And I mean, like, what the book and the film have in common, the general conceit is that the world is being threatened and it's up to all the greatest characters of the English literary canon to team up and take down a threat. So it's weird because it is that sort of buddy cop structure, but there, it's literary figures that are supernatural or special in some way, but you're right, they're not really heroes in the way that we think of. Like, because we were talking, planning this episode out, and I was saying that it's like Victorian era Avengers, and it's like, it probably has more in common with the British series, The Avengers, which also got remade into a terrible movie.
Yeah,
so it's a comic book property. It involves, it's presumably marketed to be like action and intrigue, but to call it a superhero film, I feel like that's what they're trying to do, but that's also not what this text is.
Yeah, and the short version of it is, yeah, basically it's the late, at least the initial volumes. It does shake up a little bit with the third volume, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen Century, but that's not, that came after this movie and everything else. We don't need to talk about that. But yeah, the initial volumes are basically set in the late 19th century and focus on, you know, famed characters, Alan Quatermain, Mina Harker from Dracula,
Captain Nemo, Invisible,
Captain Nemo from 20,000 Leagues, or no, yeah, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the Invisible Man from H.G. Wells' classic text, and amongst others. And it's, you know, basically the thing Alan Moore and Kevin O'Neill seem to be doing in this text is, it's not really, although if we describe the basic plot of the initial volume to you, it sounds like an adventure text. Basically, Mina Harker goes around at the behest of the British government, gathering around these individuals to be to help lead a team to stop a threat, which, if I remember correctly, in the first one comes out to be a unnamed Fu Manchu.
Yeah, it's been basically a few years since I last read it, but I think, yeah. Fu Manchu, which, when you get into the text, Eurocentrism becomes even weirder, but go on.
But yeah, so, I mean, it sounds like that's, okay, a general setup for an adventure story, but this is Alan Moore, and Alan Moore has not meant a thing he hasn't wanted to deconstruct it his entire life, and really, the entirety of the text is focused upon the fact that all the individuals who are sort of recruited for this team are in some way monstrous, and that this is ultimately a reflection of the monstrosity of the British Empire itself. Because, again, Moore very much forefronts the issues of colonialism and imperialism and the impact on the world. And the fact that, you know, Alan Quatermain, the hero of King Solomon's Mind, is nothing more than a straight-up opium junkie. The English government brings in, Edward Hyde, Dr. Jekyll's notorious alter ego, who is a monstrous serial killer here. And then you have things such as the Invisible Man, who, having apparently survived his fate at the end of H.G. Wells' original text, has gone on to become basically a serial rapist.
Well, it's like the film says, the man died, but his process lived on.
Well, we'll get into that in a little bit, because there's a bit of a story to that one as well about the rights to the character and why that kind of stuff had
what to is it with play. Alan Moore and ownership rights? It's yeah. So I guess maybe to open the conversation, though, this is, I think, what we're leading up to is, and I realize I totally just steamrolled you, Dave, and I'm sorry, but
that's okay.
So the text is very much concerned with, like, the literary trappings, but also deconstructing what they mean, what they represent, and the ways that, you know, Western literature and the canon also invisibly supports certain types of political views, certain ideological systems, and central to that is the idea of colonialism and the empire. Now, the film is not remotely concerned with doing any of that. Is that a fair assessment?
That is more than a fair assessment. This is really the case of taking the general premise and one or two story elements from the text and pretty much ignoring anything and everything else by the time we're done here.
Now, that is not unique to this adaptation.
Certainly
not. Guess that kind of merits the question because, I mean, as listeners to the show will know, David and I are big comic book fans, obsessives even, you might say. And the question that often comes up is fidelity to source material. And I guess I'd like to ask you, Dave, to open things off. If you're adapting a novel into a film, do you think that a greater fidelity to the text means that it will be a greater film for doing so? Or do you think that, porting a work to different media, that you necessarily have to make changes to it?
I go far closer towards the latter point. Ultimately, different media require different approaches to material. The question then becomes, and not to mention, I mean, certainly there's a fact that when you're adapting something, issues of personal taste, interests, and other elements come into play. And no matter what you're going to get, an adaptation of any sort of work is going to be basically skewed by these elements. And the reality is, you know, looking for some sort of quote-unquote perfectly faithful adaptation is impossible regardless, because nobody actually reads the text in the same way. I'll put it this way. I mean, look at any sort of nerdy minutia discussions amongst comic book fans, and you will find millions of people debating, you know, what is the real quote-unquote versions of given characters and the text itself.
Yeah, and then you get those lovely Reddit arguments of, look, I don't mean to sound racist, but come on, there are no black people in Valhalla. That's just ridiculous. Jesus.
But yeah, and yeah,
I guess
middle finger to those people.
If I can ask you a follow-up, though, does your answer to regarding fidelity, does that change when you're adapting a graphic novel or a comic book? because all of a sudden you have two media that are, they're concerned with visuals, superficial appearance. Like, it makes sense why comics are adapted into film often, because there's a ready-made aesthetic blueprint of what it's supposed to look like. Granted, within that blueprint, there can be a whole lot of variation. Take Batman and Robin compared to The Dark Knight Rises, for instance. And I guess I'm asking, do you think that relationship to the text changes when the text itself already is visual?
Honestly, I'm going to go no. I mean, it certainly it adds a new dimension of things to consider in terms of what you're going to be adapting. But fundamentally, it's still the same process, and there's still, you know, a million and one factors that have to be taken into account when you're adapting the material, including what is your production design going to be? What can you afford to do? What is the style of the time? Especially, I mean, if you're adapting, you know, a graphic novel that's like, you know, 30 years old, it would be kind of ridiculous to adapt all the components that go with it unless you're trying to do something very specific. And again, I mean, that still brings down to questions, you know, when we're talking about fidelity of the text. I mean, are we talking about in spirit? Are we talking about, you know, just the visuals? I mean, what else, you know, again, it's a very complex question that basically comes down to, I think, you know, broadly speaking, and not to shut it down, but if it works, it works. If it doesn't, well, it doesn't work.
Well, yeah. I mean, and I think that's, yeah. I'm inclined to agree with you that a film text is more than just its plot. It's more than just its visuals. It's a holistic thing, right? It's a system more than anything. So yeah. I don't have a lot of patience for people who are like, oh, everybody knows that the Joker didn't kill Bruce Wayne's parents, so this movie is garbage. It's like, well, I think I want to say it was Andre Bazin, the film theorist, who has an essay on adaptation, and he describes the process of adaptation like a crystalline structure where all the different iterations of a given story basically become different facets on this larger structure. So you have the film, you have the text, you have subsequent films, different rereadings. All of them form just different parts of the whole. And I think that is, I don't want to necessarily say the best way of looking at it, but I think it's a productive one because you can read laterally without necessarily having to evaluate any as being more or less in the spirit, because you can't really define that simply.
Well, yeah, and it makes it more intriguing in the specific instance we're talking about here is what we're basically talking about is an adaptation of a work which itself is pretty much adapting or at least responding to previously well-regarded and well-known texts as it's going, and more is fundamentally, in many regards, changing the perception of these things and certainly, you know, running against some of what those texts were about in the first place. So there's this very weird sort of cultural space that this film ultimately ends up coming out into, in terms of who knows what and when and why about whatever given variations of things. So like we say, King Solomon's Mines, well, there'll be the people who read the original book. There'll be those who read Alan Moore's comic, but maybe didn't read the original novel, or read the novel, but never read Alan Moore's graphic novel. And then you have the people who maybe just saw like those terrible 1980s version, starring what's-his-face.
It's in my Roger Ebert film guide, 1980 to 1985, and I'm blanking. Wasn't it like,
yeah, he was
Zed, the Mysterious Serpent, or something like that?
Well, I'm trying to remember what the name of the star was, because Richard Chamberlain, yeah, I think, did a version of King Solomon's Mines. And I'm now going to go check this, because we're going to put off talking about this actual film as long as possible.
Well, but the film,
yeah, Richard Chamberlain.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, that I think is a very good point to raise, where not only is LXG, as marketing dictates it's referred to. I mean, it itself has a very messy chain of adaptations within itself. Like, Moore's work is kind of a bricolage in a way, where he's picking up disparate elements throughout Western literature, putting them in conjunction. But also, I mean, it's not like there was never an Invisible Man film. It's not that there haven't been screen treatments of Dracula. So all of these things collide in a way that could be very interesting. And, like, I can see a film version of this existing where it does a similar sort of interrogation and breakdown of these archetypes, looking at them as they've been represented filmically. That is not what happens here.
Well, yes, and I guess, you know, before we move directly into the film version, I guess a key question I'll raise to you, Andrew, is the following. Given everything we've said, when it comes to the actual text that this film is based off of, not that this is something to really judge anything by, but just for our sakes here, do you think Alan Moore's text is one that a film adaptation should have, in one way, whatever regard you think, really should have been ultimately faithful towards? And would you have been open to being, or were you very open to a far more flexible adaptation of what he cooked up?
Okay, that's a tough one. I think I would say that, because it's been a few years since I've last read any of Alan Moore's work, for that matter. I would say that the problem is, Moore has a very clear idea of what his project is, and I think the moment that you start moving away from that, then it becomes a question of why. Like, what is this film supposed to be if it's simply taking the plot trappings of the text and not doing any kind of investigative or, like, sort of deconstructive element to it? When you take that away, then all of a sudden it's just, wouldn't it be cool if famous literary figures hung out with each other? But at the same time, though, if you make it absolutely faithful, like, David, level with me here. In 2004, somebody was saying, hey, there's a cool new action movie starring the main character from King Solomon's Mines. Would you have cared?
Well, that's the thing, is I don't think I would have cared, but I also, like, I'm so conflicted about this, because
it's like you need a knowledge and, like, an appreciation of the Western canon, problems and all. Like, you need to be well-versed in it to have any interest in seeing a deconstruction of it.
Well, and this is the thing, and, you know, I will say this, back when this film was coming out, my opinion was one of two at the time, as simplistic as it sounds, was one of two things. You can do the adaptation of Moore and O'Neill's comic as it is and try and do what they did, which honestly would A, mean that it's going to be aimed at a very limited audience, isn't going to be a big summer action movie, and probably would appeal mostly to the art house crowd by the time it's done, because it's not a, or at the very least, the horror film crowd, because so much of what constitutes this text is just shock and horror, and it really does read, it's not a pleasant,
it's not a romp, like, it's not a team up, it's more philosophy and morality than anything.
Yeah, it's a deeply unpleasant text in some ways, and some of it is, I think, very intellectually interesting. At the same time, I'm also increasingly find, particularly the older I get, that I have very little patience with Alan Moore as an author himself, because the thing about it is, he basically is stuck repeating himself over and over and over again. And two, I mean, ultimately, it's when it comes to what he did with his original text, it's kind of hard to see ultimately what he's coming down towards in terms of, yeah, British literature is problematic. Yes, colonialism is a deeply horrific subject matter, is a deeply horrific event.
Oh, thanks, Alan. I didn't realize that without you pointing it out. You know, it's
what. Well, and that's just it. I mean, it's like, okay, I get some of your, like, clever fake, you know, fake items that may have been released in the during the time period. Like, there is a like, again, in the Century comic, even though I know we said we were going to not talk about that one, you know, he has a fake ad for what is basically a doll that one can have Congress with for themselves. And I mean, the way in which he does, yeah, it's like, okay, that's kind of funny. But, you know, then we end up proceeding to have this comic, which is basically the League investigating a serial killer and an occult group, and nothing really gets achieved. And, oh, by the way, I get to pull out, you know, references to MacHeath and, you know, Bertolt Brecht.
Okay, so at that point, yeah, it basically becomes a less interesting version of Hellboy.
Really less interesting version of Hellboy. And it's one of these things where, in some ways, it just feels like Alan Moore showing off, like, hey, here's what I know.
I'm very well read, and everyone else is wrong.
Basically, and they, again, you know, not to that this really matters when it comes to the text itself, but I also find myself increasingly having a hard time with Alan Moore being the massive hypocrite and whiny, petulant child of comics that he is.
Well, because maybe if I'm going to throw a bar in front of the rant train, because sooner or later we will have to talk about this movie. But
yeah,
I think it's deeply ironic and hypocritical that someone who's so concerned with making sure that his creator rights are respected and that, you know, when a film is made that he disavows, he gets his name taken off of that. This is also someone who's the bulk of his significant works, Miracle Man, Watchmen, and League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, they're all about repurposing already existing properties. So he has no problem taking other people's work and detouring it. He just cannot stand it when other people do the same to him.
Well, what I also, I would just like to jump in here as well and note for the record that what I find hilarious is there's an upcoming Watchmen television series being done by the creator of Lost, Damian Lindelof, if I'm remembering how to pronounce his last name correctly.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah, and he basically just gave a quote within this past week where he more or less points out that, you know, A, his show's going to be more an adaptation in line with something like the Fargo television series, where we're taking ideas and themes, but it's not going to be just a, you know, strictly, you know, we're doing the graphic novel over again. But then he points, quite wisely points, it's like, also, Alan Moore's a real hypocrite when it comes to, given how many things he's done with other people's creations. So I feel like I'm completely justified in doing whatever the hell I feel like. Kudos, Lindelof. I give you credit for at least calling him out on his BS.
But it's interesting that you say that, because that sounds like it's an adaptation concerned with maintaining tone or a particular sensibility rather than plot. Whereas here, yes, we have an adaptation that's largely around plot with none of the tone or sensibilities.
And that's the thing. The thing about this movie is, I will say this. The inherent idea of trying to play the premise as a straight adventure film is not something I am actually against in theory. Because, I mean, number one, if you're going to do a big mainstream romp where it's more or less about name recognition to an audience that maybe can recognize the name Alan Quartermain but has absolutely never read King Solomon's Mind.
But if they can't, they can recognize Sean Connery.
Well, exactly. Or if you say, you know, Jekyll and Hyde, I can guarantee you 90% of the audience has probably never read the original text. But they're familiar enough from the various various film adaptations and television series and God knows what else that has been done based upon the original text that they will have an understanding of that. And yeah, I mean, things like throwing in, you know, easy literary references and character references to an audience, it might not be the most clever thing, but you could still probably play with that and do something fun with it. Whether it's like even doing a fun faux, you know, like sort of Victorian era adventure movie in the way that the 1950s did them, where you had the real mocked up, you know, it's all a backstage lot that's been made up to look like England and there's no actual English people involved here, but let's have fun with this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Star Wars A New Hope is a perfect example of how a throwback to the classic serialized style of adventure storytelling, how that can be ported into very different forms in various different decades and still be a whole lot of fun. And the problem is, I think this film doesn't ever really commit to following one approach, where it has these fantastic elements and trying to do that whole, hey, we're a team of plucky outsiders, and sort of embracing the fantastic aspects of it. But at the same time, every now and then they have to steer it into a conversation about, oh, well, also bad things are done in the name of empire, and oh, hey, World War One, and like they're trying to have it both ways, and the film really suffers for it.
Well, yeah, and this is the thing. There's probably about three things that ultimately come together, to position this movie this film could only have come out in a very particular time frame, in that weird gap between the rise of superhero cinema and the gradual death of the star system. Because this is a film which has an old school Hollywood star in the form of Sean Connery as its lead. And his presence alone, fundamentally alters the text in a way that it was never, ever going to resemble what Alan Moore did. Two, you have a director in the form of Stephen Norrington, who this was his first and ultimately last mega budget studio picture. So this is a guy with very limited, experience in this realm, but who's also coming off of doing a film like Blade, which is this hyper stylized, very much of its moment movie. And suddenly he's being thrown into this, oh, we're doing this big sort of steampunk adventure movie that's kind of a throwback, but isn't also. And that seems like a really awkward fit. And then, lo and behold, you also have a studio that doesn't really know what the hell it wants out of this at the end of the day, who's constantly interfering in it. And the end result is something that's, if nothing else, not necessarily entertaining, not necessarily good, but it is, at least historically, kind of interesting.
This is also Sean Connery's last acting credit, right?
Yes, so this is the last film of Sean Connery.
Because you were intimating a bit more, I refuse to do too much background research on this film. But this film also had a very problematic production, and not just with those three factors, but can you speak a bit more to that?
In essence, the short version, which anybody who, if you go online, you'll find more detail about this, is Sean Connery, like I said, is an old school film star, and this, by the time he's making this film, he's into his 19th or into his 70s. He had been offered a series of films that he had turned down, which turned out to be major hits. In this case, he was apparently offered the role of Morpheus in The Matrix.
Really?
Which he turned down. Apparently, at one point, that was the offer for him, and I think that was the version
That's
where...
That's nuts.
The idea was that Will Smith was being offered Neo, I think, at the time as well. Then there was The Lord of the Rings, where he was offered the role of Gandalf.
I can see that.
Yeah, that one, which he also turned that one down. And the reason he turned both of them down, by his own admission, was that he didn't understand them. Like, he just didn't get what these films were.
Oh, and the spec script for this made that much more sense?
Well, this is the thing.
It has superficiality going for it.
He openly admits that the reason he jumped on this one was because he, after seeing how much money those films made, he was going to take the next film he was offered where he didn't understand the script. That is a terrible basis on which to make any business decision, let alone career decision, and in terms of getting involved in it. But that's how we ended up here. And this film, like there were sets that ended up getting destroyed, I think, because they were flooded. Steve Norrington, again, was somebody who had come, was just rising in the ranks of directing. And this was his first mega-budget studio film. And because this is Tom Rothman era Fox, this also comes with a ton of oversight. Many, many filmmakers who worked with Fox during this run have been very open about how they swore never to work with the studio again during this regime when they were in place. Alex Proyas noted all the trouble he had making iRobot. Bryan Singer, which, putting aside the fact that he's an absolute scumbag, as we've come to discover, noted he had constant fights on the sets of the first two X-Men films about what they could and couldn't get away with, and it's kind of notable that by the time you get to things like Fantastic Four and even Daredevil, these are films where, they're choosing filmmakers to make these who are pretty much yes-men to do these things, and not you know, high caliber individual,
or at least individuals. Directors, sort of director for hire types. Workmanlike figures that aren't necessarily known for having like a unique style to themselves. Like they're the kind of people you can bring onto a film and they will make what the studio needs it to be, rather than go back and forth and have a project stuck in development hell because, well, Terrence Malick wants his Superman to look like this, damn it.
Well, and that's it. In this film, apparently, you know, there was a combination of Steve Norrington not being able to, you know, constantly fighting with the studio and wanting them to get off his back about things. And likewise, fighting it with Sean Connery, who was part of his contract. You know, you'll note he gets an executive producer credit on this thing, which I'm fairly confident Sean Connery probably had nothing to do with actually producing the movie, as it were. This was pretty much a way just to grab an extra couple bucks. And yeah, apparently the fighting between the two was extremely, extremely volatile. And that so much so that most of the supporting cast on this film has admitted in the years since. It's like, yeah, it was bad. Like, they did not get along.
Well, what would they have to fight about, though? Like, is Stephen Norrington in his bullhorn being like, now, Sean, I want this next scene. I want Quartermain to be kind of a repressive misogynist. And then Connery is like, no, I want him to be a big one. Like, this script is so vapid that it's like, where is there room for there to be clashes of creative direction? Where's the room to even interpret things differently?
Well, apparently even things like getting Sean Connery just to walk down the set more than once for multiple takes was apparently a fight just to get him to go along with that. Apparently, like, he just had no patience for anything on this film. And to be fair, this is a giant effects-heavy movie with, you know, a ton of computer-generated work, a ton of green screen work. And yeah, I can see, well, you know, like, this is Sean Connery, somebody who's been working for, you know, at this point, like 40, 50 years in this business. I mean, this is not a defense of him, but the dude is an old man. I'm sure, you know, and a guy who, even at 2003, you know, Sean Connery's still a star. Are you going to be able to be the person who tells him, you know, after 50 years, how he's to do his job? I imagine that's very difficult unless you're somebody he respects. And if you're the dude you just made Blade, I'm not saying that that was good, proper on Connery's behavior, but you can see why he might view it that this is a guy he can push around.
Well, yeah, like, Connery made Dr. No before the entire cast on this film was alive. But
yeah,
I think that might speak to, I guess, one of the bigger problems with the film, and I think it's certainly a valid point that you brought up, Dave, where it's not just that you have an aging star, but that you are suddenly transplanting them into a very different process when it's a studio-driven, like, tightly controlled, mega-budget, like, effects spectacular. That is very different from probably 99.8% of every other movie that Sean Connery made. But that's weird because the text itself seems to reflect the idea of Alan Quartermain and sort of the expiration of classical heroes. But, well, like, not in a satisfying or ingrained way. Like, this film ends up being sort of about looking towards the future and embracing what's to come with optimism. But at the same time, every single turn, whether in its production or even in its characterization of Quartermain, seems to be resisting that and being like, no, old white men are the best heroes and we're going to keep them around.
Well, okay, so before we, you know, we go down that road and explore in full here, we should probably give everybody just a grounding as to what the actual plot of this movie is.
Yeah, 40 minutes into our discussion of it.
We're nothing if not prompt and organized here, folks. Lady of Extraordinary Gentlemen, the short version is a mysterious, you know, figure, masked figure, is going around first, you know, robbing a bank in England in the year 1899, and then a couple months later, attacking a dirigible manufacturing or storage facility, I guess, where he blows the hell out of it, destroying a group of things with or balloons full of hydrogen gas, and sort of puts the world or the European world on the tip of, you know, going to war with one another. The British government ostensibly, or supposedly, sends a figure to Africa to recruit Alan Quatermain, the legendary hero who raided King Solomon's mines, to head up a group of known as the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, an organization supposedly brought up or made up of England's greatest heroes who are brought together in times of great need. And you see portraits of things such as like Robin Hood. And I think, is it Ivanhoe in the background? One of them, like just a series.
I thought Robin Hood was Ivanhoe.
I don't know. Again,
maybe that's the thing. Maybe I'm not smart enough to get it.
Who knows? But, you know, basically, he's tasked with doing this, and after, you know, dismissing, you know, patriotism and nationalism as a reason for him to go back, you know, he's quickly personally motivated, as it turns out that the battle's coming to Africa as well.
Battle's coming to Africa. It's that he's resisting, he's doing Bogart in Casablanca, just with none of the emotion and none of the development. Where he's like, I don't believe in the Empire anymore. And then all of a sudden, like, his manor house explodes. And, war has come. It's like, no, they just ruined your stuff and they want to kill you.
It's not even his house, it's his watering hole. It's, you know, just the place he goes to get drunk and hang out with a bunch of other crotchety old SOBs. I mean, it's just, it's a doozy of a 5 minutes of the film where he goes from, zero to, I guess I'm in.
Zero to hero,
And sure enough, he ends up in England, you know, and is quickly introduced to team members, Mina Murray, who is, you know, having been once bitten by Dracula, is now a vampire herself. Rodney Skinner, and Invisible Man, because apparently the rights to the Invisible Man and the actual characters from Wells Text are apparently held by Universal.
My God.
Therefore, they couldn't actually... So they vaguely reference the novel and the person who, you know, the events of that text. So instead we get the lovable rogue, you know, Rodney Skinner, Invisible Thief.
That makes a lot more sense, because when they introduce Skinner, they're like, oh, I thought the Invisible Man was dead. And he's like, actually, I'm not him. And making sure that all the lawyers in the audience are paying attention. It's, yeah, it's like he should have just come out with a placard that said, different Invisible Man.
Yeah, and then you have things like, you know, and then there's Captain Nemo, who, no, he did not die and go down with the ship, but is apparently, you know, a mildly reformed individual who is still looking to do the right thing, but I guess is doing it for the person he was fighting against in the first place. Don't ask questions, folks. It's not going to make any more sense to me to you if you try and think that one through.
All we get is like, well, I'm trying to be less of a rogue these days.
Yeah. And then, you know, lo and behold, they have to go out and recruit Dorian Gray, a character not featured in Moore's original text, who's apparently, you know, not only has his infamous portrait that he cannot look upon made him unable to age and, you know, suffer physically for the vices. He's actually a full-blown immortal capable of receiving extensive damage. And on top of that, they have to go and recruit from Paris Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, who basically imagine the Incredible Hulk if it was done with really, really terrible makeup effects.
Yeah, what if the Hulk was Abomination?
Yeah, it is like... I picked on the Thing suit from Tim Story's Fantastic Four movies, but I kind of need to apologize because, man, oh man, is the Hyde makeup in this movie awful. It is astonishing. And the transformation sequence, which is achieved with these rapid cuts and just, you know, strobe light flashes, so that they can do, you know, mid-makeup changes in between. It is astonishingly awful.
I also didn't know that they made sweatpants in 1899. So the whole team gets together, and the big plot is that now with the world destabilized due to the Phantom, all the world's leaders are going to meet in Vienna, and they figure that this is where the Phantom's shadow organization is going to strike. So they go there. Sure enough, that's exactly what happens.
Except it turns out it's all a giant scam, because there has never been a league. And it turns out the Phantom is M, the one who recruited everybody together in the first place.
And then we discover that M is not just the Phantom, he's also Professor Moriarty.
Yes, because, hey, that's a name audiences are going to recognize. Yeah, and it becomes up to, it turns out he just wanted to get, DNA samples and other stuff from all these various rogues and Alan Quartermain for some reason, to get together and, basically engineer weapons that he can sell to various sides in the upcoming war that he is about to stage between the various European nations.
See, when I heard that, I thought about that thinking back to a previous Bond film in GoldenEye, where when Trevelyan reveals his final plan, how Bond is like, interesting, all of this technology and all of this plans, you're really nothing more than a bank robber.
Yeah, and it's kind of, in the case of that film, that's kind of glorious. I love how... the best Bond films, it's not that they're trying to take over the world. It's like they have these really narrow, weird obsessions and things that they want to do where it's just like, okay, that's definitely a goal. And inherently, I don't think there's anything wrong with the plan or with the general idea of what Moriarty wants to do.
It's so labyrinthine. Yeah. Hey, we're going to dupe a whole bunch of supernatural figures together. We're going to put together a paper trail that convinces them this is a real thing. Also, the one guy that I have on the team can infiltrate, get their DNA. We can then harvest this DNA and sell it to other nations going to the war that we're trying to cause.
Yeah, no, I mean, his actual, the way in which he goes about achieving his plan makes no sense in this movie. It is absolutely gobsmackingly convoluted and unnecessary. And again, you could have just brought them all together. Again, not only that, but even if you accept the notion, okay, he needs to bring him together into a league. Why is Alan Quartermain there?
There are three immortals on the team. It's like, and the other thing is, though, without Connery, though, who is the next, who else in this film, in terms of the cast, is even recognizable?
Well, and this is the thing I think that kind of is fascinating about this film, and it's particularly noteworthy in light of the fact, we've just had Avengers Infinity War come out, and when I watched League kind of within a day or two before seeing that film, and it's kind of night and day when you recognize that really the rise of the superhero film comes at the expense of the death of the star-driven Hollywood, because really those two things are kind of incompatible. Because when you're watching something like Infinity War, that film can only exist, you can only have this multi-character team-up film when you have a group of stars who are willing to park their egos to the side and play ball with one another and share the screen.
Yeah, you raised a good point earlier where Captain America, they come out with a movie and it does gangbusters, but then you look at something like Snowpiercer where, okay, well, we still have Chris Evans, but no one's turning out to see that. As opposed to, say, the 1950s, where, Richard Burton could drag himself out of bed, gargle twice, and then roll tape, and people would flock to the theater to see that. So we're seeing this displacement from a star-driven film industry to a brand-driven film industry.
Absolutely. And this film, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, in a weird way... in terms of, the sort of meta-text of the movie and subtext of it, as unintentional as it may be, is that this is basically, the film, the last gasps of the star system before the rise of the superhero genre. Like, this is, we've come to bury our dead, the star system, and see it go away. And that's not to say that stars don't exist today, but they are the kind of one that could guarantee, we got Jim Carrey there. That's guaranteed to open a film for so many millions of dollars. That era is gone. There is basically nobody left in Hollywood who can do that. And here you have a film where, it positions a star right at its center But then because of that, you end up marginalizing everybody else who basically is having a film going on between them, while Connery is sort of distanced from everybody else in terms of his narrative relationship to what's supposedly going on in this movie.
That kind of makes a lot more sense if, if only the film was doing that on purpose.
Well, and that's exactly it. It's like, none of this, you know, is clearly deliberate, but it's fascinating as you watch the way the film plays out to realize, you know, it's ostensibly telling a tale that could work, but Sean Connery's sheer presence and inability to park his ego and play ball and recognize that he's not, you know, that this is it's a team film. It should ostensibly be a team movie where he's just part of the larger cast, and his presence just totally unbalances this film.
Yeah.
And
all of his scenes, all he does is either offer lectures, patronizing advice, or he just completely sandbags everyone. It's so weird because he is the least sympathetic, like, leading action hero I think I have ever seen in a film.
While I would say there probably are more unsympathetic ones, I would certainly say, yeah, he does this film no favors in terms of being, you know, a likable chap, unless you're solely down for, hey, I like Sean Connery being Sean Connery.
Well, yeah. He's doing
that.
His introduction to the team, he criticizes Tom Sawyer, who's already rescued him once. He criticizes the way that he fires a gun. He criticizes Dorian Gray for newfangled automobiles. And then when Mina Harker tries to talk to him, he basically shuts her down. He's like, oh, by the way, I've also had two wives and many lovers, so I don't need your distractions around me. Now everyone shut up.
Yeah, I mean, he is a rampant misogynist. He's a pain in the behind. And the thing about it is he's also the least interesting character in this film, because all around him, everybody else has their own little subplots and texts going on. Meanwhile, the closest thing he has is this quote-unquote father-son relationship with Tom Sawyer, which, number one, I'm pretty sure doesn't make sense, because, correct me if I'm wrong, Andrew, just, you know, the original Tom Sawyer novels not take place in, like, the mid-1800s when he's, like, 12 or something?
I think so.
Yeah, but so he should be, like, a 50-year-old man at this point, well, not a...
Elastic reality, David, the same way that newspaper seems to know what tanks are in 1899. It's...
Yeah. Fair enough.
Like, but again, this is a film that wants to have it both ways, where it wants to ground itself and ground itself in history while at the same time being allowed to be as elastic as it needs to. And the same way that, like, Alan Quartermain's powers aren't ever really defined. Like, we're told that, a witch doctor placed a protective spell on him, and it means that if he's ever buried, like, Africa will not let him die. What does that mean, though? In effect, it means that he can do whatever the scene requires him to be able to do.
Well, and this is the thing. The film is structured around, at least as far as the quote-unquote character arc of Alan Quartermain in this film, is basically him passing the baton to Tom Sawyer. And it climaxes in this line as Quartermain dies at the end of the film. Yeah, spoilers, as if anybody cares. But, I mean, as he's dying, he's basically telling Tom, it's like, make the next century yours, like the last one was mine. And it's this... I apologize for my comment.
You have a great Connery. A lot better than mine.
Well, but it's like this... He gives this line which... Yeah, okay, fine. Old man dies, young man takes over.
Yeah.
And it's something we've seen in films like even such as the original Men in Black. Here's the thing.
I was going to say Saving Private Ryan.
Well, Saving Private Ryan as well, but I mean, in that case, that's not like the start of a mega budget franchise.
It could have been. We just need more world wars.
Oh, God. But yeah, in the case of something like Men in Black, you have a film in which Tommy Lee Jones, you know, and Will Smith are coming up against each other. And Will Smith is an up-and-coming star who, you know, was, you know, this is him right as he's achieving his, you know, becoming box office gold at a time. And you have Tommy Lee Jones, who's been, you know, a well-worn actor, he's been around for decades at this point, and people like him, people know him. So in terms of their star presence and balance on screen, they are, you know, again, they can go head to head with one another and it works.
Yeah.
Here,
but like the text and the metatext are aligned there. Whereas, exactly. I don't even, who's the actor that plays Tom Sawyer?
It is Shane West.
So it's not like he became a bankable commodity. It's not like this was handing over a franchise to this guy. It's not, it rings so hollow, and it's, okay, this is a film that's full of reversals as well, where, oh, it's the Phantom. No, he's really M. No, he's really Moriarty. The Invisible Man's the mole. No, it's really Dorian Gray. Oh, the Invisible Man's on our side. And, like, things just happen, but, like, and there's even that confrontation between Quartermain and the Phantom, where he's like, oh, do not assume you understand my methods. And so he doesn't, and then they just never come back to it. But, like, the final scene where Quartermain is buried, and the rest of the team, like, they kind of realize, sort of under the leadership of Nemo, hey, we've done something great here. We can keep this team alive, and we can face whatever challenges the next century holds for us. Guys, we did. It feels like, hey, the team finally feels organic, and it works. And, yeah, we don't need regressive colonial holdovers, you know, going around, like, raining on everybody else's parade. That feels like that transition moment. And then we have the witch doctor appear and wave his stick, and then lightning strikes the grave, and it's like, oh, well, I guess we can't get rid of old action stars after all. And, like, we're supposed to feel happy that this jerk can't die.
Well, this jerk can't die, and what makes the scene even funnier, that you sort of just underscored as well, is that, okay, if you think about the way the character arc of this film is operating, ostensibly, Tom Sawyer is the one who should be stepping into a position of leadership, and he's not. It's Captain Nemo, the guy who's basically been sidelined as transportation captain for this entire group, and, you know, dude who will build you magnificent automobiles and, you know, sword-shaped ships. Say that five times fast. You know, he's the one who takes hold. So it's like, okay, Sawyer can't even step into what is ostensibly the whole nature of his relationship with, you know, Alan Quartermain in the first place. So why is he here?
But he did, like, take the perfect shot at the end, striking down Moriarty, all because he was getting lectured by Sean Connery how to do it while it was happening. It's just,
yeah.
This film really feels like, okay, it's like in the early 90s where you have, like, Disclosure, you have Basic Instinct, you have, like, this sort of backlash against, you know, greater role of powerful women in the workplace, you have changing social structures and that. So you see these, like, male panic films. And then the inverse of that is you see, like, the, you know, Rambo 3 and, like, this throwback return to hypermasculinity. And I feel like this film, it comes off like it's a reactionary film in that way, where it's like, the world is changing. We have this diverse team of misfits and, you know, and women and people that are just rejected and held down by the crown and the empire. Well, no, Alan Quartermain, he's the one who will get us through. He'll tell us what to do. It feels like the Connery archetype of action star is, like, screaming to maintain its relevance. And I feel like the film is trying to help it scream, and it fails at every turn.
Oh, absolutely. And it's weird how the film tries to, at the same time, try and, you know, sort of negate that while it's doing it, because, you know, you have this very strong regressive streak, but then you give Alan Quartermain, you know, these half-hearted lines about how he doesn't need the empire, and, you know, how he lost friends, and he gets the line where he gets to know both white men and black, because we need to make clear that despite the fact that Alan Quartermain is basically, you know, colonialism embodied in one form.
Yeah, he is the empire.
Yeah, he is the empire. No, he's not racist. You know, he had friends. You know, he can't be racist if he had friends.
Because he recognizes, like, that there are only two categories of people in the world.
Exactly. And it's just like, you've got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
Like, this is so, so bad. And yet, again, you know, this, even though the whole film structure on this is terrible, there are kind of things at the peripheries to like.
Okay, maybe we should steer it into there. What? Yeah, because, like, I think as we've alluded to before, like, even though the rest of the cast isn't top-line actors in that, like, I feel like they're mostly British TV character workers, the little bits that we get from the rest of the cast is so much more interesting than anything that's happening in, like, the A-plot.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would say probably the actor who gets out of this thing the most unscathed and comes out the best, and I'm likely to mispronounce his name, so... Andrew, if I do this, please correct me if you know the proper pronunciation. Nasiruddin Shah?
Nasiruddin Shah? That's how I would say it.
Yeah, I'm not... Again, we probably botched it, and we do apologize if he happens to be listening in. But it's... Again, he... First of all, it's congratulations. It's Captain Nemo being played by somebody who's not white, so... That's a start, so kudos there. But he brings a lot of dignity to a role that really, on the page, has nothing there, for the most part. But he comes in, and yeah, you buy this guy as somebody who, he's running the ship. He is pretty much, you know, going around the seven seas with all this hyper-advanced technology. And again, I should note for the record, the production design on his vehicles and the Nautilus itself... are actually pretty darn good. I kind of like their navigation room and elements like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's cool in, like, that diesel punk sensibility. And, like, it works. And, yeah, I think the way that he plays Nemo, like, it's... I feel like he's a good counterpoint to Quatermain. And in those few dialogue scenes they have, like, Quatermain sort of throws shade. And he's like, oh, I thought you used to be a pirate. I'm not going to do a Connery voice anymore, but, like, Nemo basically just gives him the side eye, and he's like, this is my boat, sit down. And, like, he's not taking any guff, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's able to stand toe-to-toe with Connery, and...
But his sword fight scene is actually pretty cool. It's, like, the best of the middling action scenes.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's actually physically capable of doing things, which is more than can be said for Sean Connery's I can punch once and I can punch twice, and that's going to be about all I mean, seriously, watch every fisticuff he gets into this film. It's terrible.
Because he makes the first one count, David. That's classic Scottish workmanship.
Apparently. But yeah, I mean, you got that. I think, you know, Stuart Townsend, who I swear, like... He was one of those guys who looked like he was always on the verge of breaking out, and then it never happened. I mean, getting fired from Lord of the Rings was bad sign number one. Getting hired for
Queen of the Damned was bad sign number two.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's just like he was always kind of about to break out, and then it never happened. I like him in Dorian Gray playing Dorian Gray, because basically he seems to realize this is a terrible movie, so I am just gonna camp it up like nobody's business.
Yeah, he comes off the most self-aware. He looks like he's actually having fun. And I think, you know, he doesn't have a lot to do, as nobody in this film does. But, you know, he plays with that sort of, you know, the menacing dandy. I think he does well. He's a very handsome cat, so at least they got that part right.
Yeah, and I mean, Tony Curran as, you know, Rodney Skinner, as much as we may make fun of how, you know, he's basically just reinvented as a lovable thief here. I mean, Curran's a good actor. If you've seen the episode, and I know you're going to groan, Andrew, of Doctor Who, where he plays Vincent Van Gogh, he does he will break your heart in 1 hour in that episode. He does gobsmackingly great work. Helps say he has a great script from Richard Curtis as well. But, I mean, here he's just asked to be Charming Rogue, and he does it. And it's fine. I mean, it's a waste of his talent, but, I mean... he does what he's asked of him, and like, likewise with
the problem with having Wilson. The Invisible Man for a character, though, is that it's its own deus ex machina, because when all seems lost, oh, something you didn't see coming saves the day. There were a couple scenes that I liked, though. I like when, you know, he's first introduced, and it's just the voice, and then he puts on the coat, and then he, like, puts little swatches of face makeup on, and it just hangs there. I think, like, obviously the technology hasn't aged terribly well, but I think the more limited effects like that one actually do hold up, and, you know, it's interesting. I don't remember seeing a lot of that in 2003. But then there's also, like, those moments where they use CG for just dumb visual jokes. Like, when they all toast, and he drinks a glass of whiskey, and everyone can see it, like, go down his invisible throat. That, I get that it's a gag, but it also makes no sense. Because it's like, oh, so otherwise he's constantly near starved to death and severely dehydrated when he's walking around the rest of the time? Like, what if he eats? Do people suddenly just, like, look in the corner and they see, like, this ball of mashed-up food walking around?
I'm trying to remember. I think that was a gag in Memoirs of an Invisible Man as well. That Chevy Chase classic that we all remember.
Maybe I'll pick that one for you sometime. But yeah, like, I have Corinne, he's fine. He's playing a rogue, and he's charming and roguish. So nothing wrong there. I think Jason Fleming, I was probably most impressed by, who plays Dr. Jekyll, because it's weird. He seems to get the only, like, emotional moments, and they only seem to happen, like, as inner monologues with himself. Like, in particular, there's the scene where he's on the boat, and he starts talking to himself, and as he's walking down the hallway, like, his reflection in the window is in the form of Hyde, and he basically externalizes his internal monologue. And, like, that's the only thing that comes close to, like, an emotional beat, I think, other than, you know, Quartermain being like, oh, by the way, my son's dead. The problem with Fleming, though, is that he is burdened by a whole lot of bad makeup and even worse CGI, and he's the Hulk of the team. So, I mean, he's kind of limited in how much he can really do in terms of acting.
Well, no, that's exactly it. I mean, he doesn't get a heck of a lot to do, and, I mean, what he does get to do, you have to really strain to look past the terrible makeup that he's been stuck with. Because, I mean, again, I get what they're trying to do. Like, it's the one image that's probably most evocative of the original source comics, which is the idea of the sort of smaller-headed Mr. Hyde, where it's this tiny head on top of this grotesquely over-top heavy body, it works on the page, but it does not translate at all to cinema.
Same thing with Reed Richards, you know? Some things just can't be done in a way that looks good.
Or at least not one where the aesthetic is going to be realistic. And unfortunately, when you have a film where more often than not, I'm not going to say it's realism, but at least they're trying to create a context of reality where this makes sense, this one stands out like a sore thumb, to say the least. But then that brings us to the two we haven't really, well, three, I guess, we haven't talked about, which is Shane West, or as I like to call him, Johnny McHandsome. That's his role. That's literally all you're going to get out of him. He has zero charisma, no real chops to hold the screen. He's just token American.
Yeah, he shows up to be the sidekick and to occasionally ask Quartermain a probing question.
Yeah, and I mean, it also, because the fact he's the lone American in the group, that makes that weird sort of handoff scene at the end, almost like this weird, and we're passing it off from the British to the Americans, you know, make the next century your own. It's like, okay, yeah, we get it. America rises to power in the 20th century, but da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, not really adding anything to this film, but okay. Peta Wilson, who gets to be the sole woman with female character this entire film.
Yeah, literally, she's the only one, other than, like, crowd extras.
Yeah, and I give her credit because she's trying. She is trying to do stuff in this movie that at least will be mildly interesting.
For scenes with Townsend, she recuses herself well, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, she does well there, but then you get things like, there's a scene right after they leave Dorian Gray's building and are just waiting on the docks for the Nautilus to show up. She gives this monologue about how she ended up in her current condition as a vampire. And between the painful writing of James Dale Robinson, who we haven't mentioned by name up until this point, who, funny enough, also works in comics, and, you know, is, at least early in his career, rather acclaimed. As you can tell, his script, terrible here. But, you know, she gives this terrible monologue, and it's shot in a way where it's like, you know what? What's the least interesting way and most stagey way it can happen? Yeah, just put the camera there. She'll walk in front of the audience and just, you know, monologue for no reason while Sean Connery looks bored over in the corner. So, yeah, I mean, she fights. She tries, but it just doesn't work here. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
I think everyone's kind of hobbled by the fact that this is one of those scripts that feels like every line has been agonized over to the point where, like, you know, you can almost see somebody, like, sitting at a typewriter or whatever being like, yes, nailed it. Because, like, every characters don't speak naturally to one another. Everything is a pronouncement, right? It's just, even that first line of, like, your empire needs you. Yes, but the question is, do I need the empire? And, like, it feels like it's not a script. It's an assemblage of quotes. And that kind of limits how naturalistic, you know, the presentation of that can be. This film also does something that I really hate, where it makes allusions and references in dialogue or in visual motifs, but then it feels the need to explain the reference. And it's like, this isn't the worst offender that I've seen, but I've always been baffled by that, where it's like, hey, we're going to throw a clever little throwaway reference to something into our film. Yeah, but what if not everybody understands that? Oh, good point. We better explain so people know just how clever we are. So, like, there's the part where Quartermain gets out of the newfangled automobile, and they're like, wow, we got here fast. He's like, yes, but not as good as Phileas Fogg. And then there's a beat pause, and then he goes, around the world in 80 days. And I just thought, like, if only a character responded with, yes, Alan, that is a popular novel of this time period.
At least they didn't explain Call Me Ishmael, which...
Oh, I mean, groaned at that one, too.
As you should, but it's at least they feel it's like, okay, if they don't get that one, who cares?
But I think maybe that speaks to a bigger question I have for you, David. Who is this film for? Because, like, my dad is a Sean Connery fan. He has read King Solomon's Mines. He ended up going to see this at the movies by himself one afternoon. And, you know, if we ever decide to drop our clean listening tag, I'd play the audio of that. But it's like, this film is old movie stars and old archetypes and historical and literary references funneled through a diesel punk lens, special effects driven, you know, presumably like a fast-paced modern type of filmmaking. So young audiences will like the aesthetics, but they're not going to understand or recognize the characters. Older audiences will understand the characters, but they're probably not going to care for this style of filmmaking. Like, what's the point of League of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Well, and that's, you're hitting the nail right on the head, is that this is a film that tries to be for everybody and succeeds in being for nobody. And, I mean, if it wanted to be, you know, something for the people who are hardcore literary, you know, nerds and love this stuff, and I would have no problem with that, like, good, do that. But this film, because it cost over $100 million to make, was never going to be that. So yeah,
they gave $100 million for a problematic property with one A-list actor made by a studio that had no vested interest in making comic book properties. They gave $100 million to this.
And, well, above that, because then there was, like, again, because of the trouble production, the cost kept going up and up. and up as this thing went through. I mean, this was not a cheap movie, and it didn't make its coin back.
Yeah, but I mean, like, when you have... Okay, studio interference is one thing, but it's like the reported, like, 4.5-hour cut of Dawn of Justice, where it's like, yeah. No, if you're a film studio and you're allowing people to make a 4.5-hour film on your time, your sets, your budget, you know fully well that you are not releasing that film as is. So the very fact that you allowed it to bloat to that point means there's something wrong. In the same way that this film is an abject failure, but you can't necessarily pin it solely on cast and crew. You have to realize, yeah, I mean, this is a studio that didn't even like what they were doing, and they gave it twice the budget of most other films of its day.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's ludicrous that this thing cost as much as it should. Like, I mean, if there was going to be a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen film, it should have, I mean, at most, costs around between 60 and 70 million in that day's dollars. And that's putting it at a high flipping amount, to say the least. I mean, but again, and it probably should have been something more along the lines of, it's going to be a $50 million small drama, rated R, and, you know, just, you know, make it for the people who, you know, like the comic and are probably predisposed to enjoying that kind of literary critique.
Or just be like, hey, why don't we just focus on Jason Fleming's Dr. Jekyll and make an interesting small movie out of that? Oh, well, he's not marketable enough. Oh, yes, and septuagenarian Sean Connery is? Like, oh, I want to reach back through time and just start slapping people.
Well, and this is the thing. In the fact that this becomes Sean Connery's last film, I mean, it effectively, yeah, I mean, this is a film about burying your stars at the end of the day, literally and figuratively. And again, as unintentional as that may be, that in a roundabout way, I kind of understand people, you know, wanting to come back and maybe watch this, not because it's a good movie, but just to try and, you know, see where the crossroads everything was at around 2003. Because again, this is the same summer that X2 comes out. Spider-Man comes out. Spider-Man's a year prior to this. X3 comes out this year. And again, you know, this is the... And The Hulk comes out in 2003 as well.
Mm-hmm.
And again, all of those films around aren't really starring big-name actors. Tobey Maguire, you know, God bless him. Nobody was going to see movies based on Tobey Maguire being in them.
I don't know. There was probably a diehard contingent of Cider House Rules fans.
Okay, apparently. Well, maybe if Tobey Maguire had played Alan Quartermain, those Cider House Rules fans would have shown up for the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
And Michael Caine could have played Tom Sawyer.
There we go.
He'd be age appropriate.
Of course.
Hello, love. I was born in Mississippi. It would be no less nonsensical than anything else in this film.
Oh no, you're not wrong. I mean, it would be up there with Jaws the Revenge in terms of what the hell was everybody thinking and entertainment value at that point.
Everyone's got bills to pay. But
indeed.
I guess winding down, David, do you have anything to offer for hits and pits?
One hit. There is one scene that I think is legitimately really funny and worthwhile. And again,
okay.
Stuart Townsend. Stuart Townsend, God bless him. There's a line where, as they basically, on a phonograph, Moriarty and Dorian Gray are basically detailing to the League what their scheme was the entire time. And there's a point
that was courteous of them.
Yeah, and I like that Moriarty, he delivers this line about, you know, how I had to put a wolf amongst the sheep. And you just cut to Stuart Townsend, who, as deadpan as he can, just says, growl.
Okay, yes. That was kind of good.
It's the small things that make these films bearable. But what about you, Andrew? You got a hit at all that we haven't mentioned?
That we haven't mentioned? No, because I'm finding out the actor's performances I like. Like, Trevor Jones' score, it's too inoffensive to really be notable. Yeah, it's just like, even everything is so generic. That's the problem. And that even the good moments are pulled down by the law of averages. So, I mean, that I think is probably the biggest shame of this film, where it's not bad enough that it reaches bonkers territory where it's fun and crazy to talk about. It's just all sort of middling. But I will say, David, in talking about this film with you, I feel like understanding some of its production context and thinking about it in terms of like the incompatibility between like the old and new systems of filmmaking, that's not enough to make this film good or anything I would recommend to anybody. But I think in terms of a snapshot of a very weird point of juncture in time, I think I can understand a value to this film that I wouldn't have recognized previously.
So, well, that's all I can hope for out of this episode.
I am still furious with you. You are not off the hook yet.
I didn't think I would be.
This film is almost 2 hours long.
Yeah, and
I am never getting those 2 hours back, David. I'm a very busy man.
I apologize. I promise you the next time I select a bad movie, I will try and keep it under 80 minutes. But I can't guarantee that that's also going to happen either. So,
well, that's okay.
That's the breaks.
I mean, can't be any more heartbreaking than the good Lord Sean Connery finally bowing out on this note. But hey, if that's what needed to happen, and films like this needed to happen for an old style of filmmaking with, you know, just a very locked in and narrow definition of heroes, masculinity, and justice, and all of that, if this film had to be made for all of that to be put in the grave, I guess it's a price well paid.
I will say this, and you can answer me this question. Yes or no? Would this film have been better if Roger Moore had been playing Alan Quartermain?
Yes, but only if Connery was revealed to be Moriarty.
I would be perfectly down with that. There, we've established it. The one time Alan Moore would have been better than Sean Connery at something. So,
Roger Moore.
Duh,
Alan Moore is never better at anybody at anything.
I'm now just imagining the never-made film with Roger Moore playing Alan Moore, and it is the greatest thing will never actually get to see.
And you can fund that project on our Kickstarter as soon as it's available. The more, the merrier.
It's probably a good point not to tell you to look up and see whether Roger Moore is dead or not. But
quiet, David. We can still get $100 million from Fox.
Fair enough.
All right.
So that's that. So Andrew, I am now, well, I'm not so much relinquishing the wheel as it is you just disabled it and removed it and put it in your
I'm making an executive decision. Yes. I guess here's what I was thinking. LXG kind of overlays with horror. I mean, in the same way that where you have some classic monster archetypes. Oddly enough, exactly like Universal tried to do with the Dark Universe, that also failed spectacularly. But I also realized, we haven't looked at horror, have we? I mean, well, Angel Heart as a horror slash, but...
Yeah.
So I think to correct that, we're not going to follow any of the main characters. In fact, we're not going to follow anybody that you would probably even recognize. But in League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Quartermain's friend Nigel at the very beginning is played by a British actor named David Hemmings. And in 1975, David Hemmings happened to star in Dario Argento's horror giallo film Deep Red. So I think it'll be a chance for us to look at crazy 70s filmmaking, to go across the pond and see how they do it in Italy, and also see something that's invariably going to be better than League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
I can tell you right now, Andrew, that James is probably very excited with your announcement.
Okay, so. Well, here's hoping that we didn't scare off our entire listener base with this episode, don't worry, folks. It gets better. So, David, is there anything that you'd like to plug?
I'm on Twitter, and occasionally you'll find me making, you know, random jokes like how Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen was basically Torchwood Season 1. Which one's getting insulted in that instance? You decide. But, so you can find me at 24 Panels there. What about you, Andrew?
You can find me at Filmstripper. You can also find me searching Andrew Kanegeezer on SoundCloud if you want to listen to a bunch of free music. And, David, I should have asked you this before we started recording, but is there any place that people can review or rate our podcast?
There's a place called iTunes. It's a small little site. You probably haven't heard of it. But you can give 5-star reviews there. Those are very beneficial to us. The good news is you can't select anything other than 5. So
really,
you know, hey, decisions made for you.
Oh, wow.
No, not really. Okay. But
honestly, I mean, David and I, we do this out of fun. We do it because we love talking to each other. And, you know, movies are a fantastic thing. And if the best way to help grow an audience and take in suggestions and that, 5-star reviews on iTunes are the most effective way to get our stuff out there. So if you like what you're hearing, you can leave a print review talking about how horrible we are, give it 5 stars, and at least somebody else is bound to see it. So that would be wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. So on that note, Andrew, any parting words before we leave the LXG?
Yes. Remember, everybody, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you unless the continent of Africa refuses to allow you to die.
Goodbye, folks.